Okay, I think it's time to begin, Tim. Am I on?
Yes, you're good.
All right. Well, good evening to everyone. Glad to have you back. And continue to be grateful for your interest in this topic, one that I think is always worthy of study. We need to put in historical perspective things that have happened with the church, again, to learn the lessons from it. Just as the Old Testament taught teaches the church lessons, so church history itself teaches us lessons to learn about the church and about mistakes it's made and the things we can learn from it. I think that's particularly true tonight as we discuss a topic that really often is not discussed in relation to the history of the Restoration, and that is the Civil War and its effect upon the church, both before, during, and after the war. So I hope we'll look at some things that will be helpful and will help to teach us some lessons. Well, the first half of the 1800s was a time where the church grew tremendously. Its influence grew, its numbers grew, its understanding of the basic New Testament principle of restoration understanding throughout the nation was becoming greater and more appreciated, and more people were seeking to follow that very principle and breaking not just from Catholicism but from denominationalism in order to become one who practiced simple New Testament Christianity. But it's a time that even though it's enjoying a great success, it is going to come to an end by the time you get to the middle of the century. And that's what we're looking at tonight. The Civil War was without doubt one of the worst periods of time in the history of this nation. Has often been referred to as our nation's darkest hour. And it's hard to get away from that being true. It has a tremendous effect upon how the nation even views itself. Before the war, it viewed itself as more of a loose confederation of states. After the war, it becomes to view itself more as a united nation of states. I believe it's in Ken Burns' series on the Civil War that he makes the observation that before the war, the statement was the United States are. And afterwards, it says the United States is, that is showing the union being more recognized after that. But before that happens, awful things happen in this country that certainly have to be overcome, not only by the country, but certainly in the church itself, because so often what is happening in the nation is reflected within the church itself as it has to deal with the same things. We are citizens of our nation as well as citizens of the kingdom. And one is going to influence the other. So the church did not escape the horrible things that happened leading up to and during the war and even the consequences of it. And we have to examine the church in the light of these things that were happening during that time. It's important to recognize it did have a tremendous effect. Not all historians, as you read them, writing on Restoration history, give the Civil War its due in terms of the damage that it did to the Lord's church going forward. The church did recover, but the division that was caused by it is never really healed. And so division will be something that characterizes the church going forward from this time. Of course, there are two major issues that are involved in this. And the first and most obvious is slavery. But the second one we often don't think about in terms of the church is pacifism. And I want us to look at both of those. I think to help to understand the context of this time, this issue, is to understand where slavery was at the beginning of the Civil War and how slavery had increased exponentially in the first half of the century, from the late 1700s until the time of the Civil War. A list in the sidebar on the left in page 1 some things that help us to understand the magnitude of this matter by the time you get to the middle of the 1800s. In the beginning, no states had outlawed slavery, but it began to happen pretty quickly. In 1780, Pennsylvania outlawed slavery from the standpoint of saying from that point forward, any child born in slavery would be set free at age 18. So that was already looking forward from that standpoint. But in 1783, Massachusetts declared all slaves free immediately. And that's going to be more of what happens going forward from that time. In 1800, there are still some significant slave populations in northern states. I think New York had about 20,000 slaves. And New Jersey had, I think, maybe 5,000, Delaware somewhere in that number. Most of the others had relatively no slaves. But even those numbers have to be put in the context by that by 1800, there were over 1 million slaves in the United States. And when the Civil War starts, there are about 4 million slaves in this country. Let me show you a quick map here that I think helps us see this. I couldn't get this any bigger, but it is a map that's showing the spread of slavery at the time of the mid-century, the time of the Civil War. It only shows it in the southern states because basically that's the only place there were slaves. And you see the squares, the darker the squares, then the more slaves that were possessed or that were found in that area. And so you see how heavily the slave holdings were in the South, spreading over into Texas, into Missouri, and into some of the new territories that came in later, in which compromises were attempted to be made, even in states coming in, maybe one state that would come in slave would come in while another one was allowed in free, with freedom from slaves. But this is how you see the distribution of slaves. So you understand how this certainly becomes a sectional or a regional issue because of the heavy, almost all slave holdings being in the South during this time. And by the time you get to the time of the war, and you take all the states that seceded from the Union, statistics show that one-third or 32% of the households in those states held slaves. It'd go anywhere from one to two to up into hundreds on large plantations. But that's obviously where the slave-holding states were, where you would find them during that time. And so you do find that division occurring regionally for that reason. Slavery and many other social issues are not really addressed in the beginning of the Reformation movement in the early 1800s. And a couple of historians make this observation about it, that it's just that social issues were not on the radar at that particular time in the movement because the movement was so excited about the very principles of restoration, of seeking union among all Christians upon the basis of the scriptures and making that restoration plea and the break coming from the human creeds and getting back to simple New Testament Christianity. That they were centered upon that and social issues, well, that'll be dealt with in time. But right now we're trying to spread simple New Testament Christianity, trying to restore New Testament Christianity. And so I think Ted Harrell expresses it by saying that slavery with every other problem was simply gulped down along with every other, all the social issues during that time because they were so exuberant about the principles of restoration that they involved in and the tremendous growth that was going on. So slavery is going to have to be dealt with, but at the beginning, it's not really dealt with strongly. But the views of leaders in the restoration movement in the beginning were very anti-slavery. Martin W. Stone, Thomas Campbell, Alexander Campbell, all who had possessed a few slaves earlier in their life, released them. And they wrote extensively in opposition to slavery and its inhumanity. They opposed it, and many other religious leaders in the Restoration Movement opposed slavery, but obviously not all. A survey that was done of slaveholders by churches, by different kinds of churches, show that the Disciples Movement, the Disciples of Christ, the Restoration Movement churches, were among, that population was among the highest holders of slaves in that time period. So it wasn't like all the church opposed slavery and were letting their slaves go. They were not. They rather were, they were wrestling with the issue, but not certainly willing or ready to give up their slaves. And as we see, as the division grows stronger, many of them become adamant in their defense of slaveholding during this time. And Harold makes the observation that if you ask most of the New Testament Christians during that time about the souls of slaves, they would say almost to the man that a slave is a human being and worthy of God's grace and salvation, and wanted slaves to be Christians. And it's very clear they didn't put them on the same level as the white man, that he was a second-class Christian. But they did believe in that, that they had the right to become Christians. There were churches, black churches during that time, but that wasn't the standard practice. You would find black churches on large plantations many times. But the practice during that time was that blacks and whites met together in churches, but separated. There would be a specific gallery for the slaves, or even a balcony area where they would go, separate from the white Christians. And so again, obviously on a different level, not considered, on a level with the white Christians. And that is obviously not a practice to be defended, but in some ways it did stand out from some other churches who simply would not let or consider African Americans being in their assemblies at all. But that was a more common practice during that time. Those who opposed slavery weren't necessarily in favor, those who opposed slavery in the church were not necessarily in favor of immediate abolition of slavery. They believed that it should be a gradual emancipation so that the economy of the nation, particularly the South, would not be wrecked. A very popular movement during the time was emancipation and colonization, as they called it. That is, that African American slaves be set free and then be taken back to Africa, recolonized and supported there so that they could reestablish themselves on the continent. A very popular position early on, though really never gained much traction. Liberia was the province that they established on the west coast of Africa. And they, many churches and individuals supported, gave financial support to helping freed slaves go back to Africa, to Liberia. But actually, there were never more than about 15,000, which did that, both of slave and free African Americans that were taken back or went back there. But that was an American effort from that standpoint. It was identified with America. Its capital, Monrovia, was named after President James Monroe. But as I say, it didn't really work, didn't take traction, and particularly as lines began to be drawn more strongly and the sides separated, then support for that fell by the wayside as not being workable during that time. So the problem of dealing with slavery becomes one that is being pressed to the fore, and sides are being drawn more strongly. Really, the ones who began to press the issue the most at this time are the abolitionists. But they began to press heavily for immediate emancipation of all slaves. This will do a lot to, of course, crystallize the two sides of the movement. Now, believe me, I'm not criticizing that. I'm just trying to state historically what happened. And the issue needed to be brought to a head so it could be dealt with. And it is the abolitionist movement that causes this to really begin to happen. There are rebellions that take place. John Brown, who is famous for the Harper's Ferry Rebellion in 1859, actually had been leading insurrections in Kansas back in the 1840s. They were armed insurrections that took place back in Kansas, led by John Brown, who militarily tried to take over towns or run slaveholders out of towns. So it was actions like that that really brought it to a head as abolitionists really began to press their view. The problem as it arose within the church was one that was happening in all the denominations. All of them were having to deal with this issue. And really, the separation that occurs in them clearly crystallizes by the beginning of the war. Both the Methodist and Baptist denominations had completely divided. There were two separate groups by the time the war began, and that was true of most of them during that time. What happens among leaders in the Restoration is the question in their mind becomes not so much slave or free. They're becoming concerned about the Lord's church being divided. And they are deeply concerned about how to resolve this without the church splitting. Now, slavery is a moral issue. There's no doubt about it. But in the effort to try to hold the church together, to hold brethren together, they began to compromise somewhat on how they dealt with slavery, or thought it could be dealt with. They tried to move slavery from the realm of a religious or moral issue to being a political issue and let politics deal with that and let the church continue to try to teach simple New Testament Christianity, be disciples of the Lord, and we'll evangelize whites and African Americans and continue that and let that be decided otherwise. It even finally forces them, some of them, to make some defense of slavery in order to mollify both sides. And of course, that doesn't work. That didn't solve anything. In fact, all it did was enrage more both sides of the aisle on that discussion among brethren. And so things just got worse and worse. Campbell was getting toward the end of his life. He was going to die in 1866. And one of his most impassioned pleas toward the end in his writings in 1860 and shortly after that, in his last issue that he edited with Millennial Harbinger, he made an impassioned plea for the church to stay united and not to allow these things to divide them and to show patience and understanding with each other. But of course, that was not what was to happen. Radical preachers, as preachers began to try to defend the practice of slavery, there were many who did that. Many of them became very radicalized about it. As I said, this becomes a regional issue. And there was already acrimony, resentment of the South against the North. and the North's view of the South, or he viewing these as regional situations. The North was much more affluent than the South. And outside of the Southern plantations, there was not a lot of wealth to be found. There was a merchant class, but there wasn't a lot of wealth to be found even then, and it gets worse after the war. But the division the defense that takes place in the South is very much a part to defend the economy of the South and the continuum of the South, because of the necessity of the slaves to continue the economy of the South. I listed on page 2 some of the arguments brethren made for slavery, very specious arguments and ones that we would openly reject now. I think to some extent, we have to try to put ourselves in the mindset of those brethren. It does not justify in any way, don't misunderstand me, but that they're trying to figure out how to save the country as far as they're concerned, how to continue to provide a living by not having the economy of their whole region of the country destroyed. It should be, first of all, a moral and religious issue, but for them, it's also becoming an economic issue that they've got to try to figure out how to deal with. And in that setting, it takes a long time to solve it, and actually for it to come to a head. I mean, it's 75 years after the war for before the beginning of the war for independence, before this comes to a head in the Civil War. That's how long it takes, because it is a thorny and it is a issue that is rooted in the country itself and in its founding and in its social economic system. So as this develops, as often happens, the radical extremes come to have the greatest influence, and they crystallize the two sides. There was in this movement radical abolitionists, radical slave defenders, and there were moderates. That's actually reflected in the election in 1860, of Abraham Lincoln's election. Lincoln carried the northern states. I can't even think of the southern candidate right now. He carried the southern states. And then there were two moderate candidates whose strongest support was in the border states. That's where the moderates were. They were the ones having to deal with people on both sides of the issue, even within families and their neighbors. So that's where the moderates ruled. But of course, the northern states had a much larger population. And even though Lincoln only got 40% of the popular vote, he carried the northern states easily, who had many more electors. So the division of the country is clear in the voting in that election. And of course, shortly after that, then the decision is made to secede, and everything then falls apart from that point forward. The slave defending preachers in the South in the church want to place the blame upon divisiveness in the church upon the abolitionists. They want to point back that the abolitionists started all this problem. But the radicalism of the Southern slave defenders was as adamant and in many ways much worse than the abolitionists. The abolitionists, many of them, supported insurrection even against the U.S. government, because they would not declare emancipation. What John Brown did at Harper's Ferry just before the war was that's where the military armory was. And he attacked it with the intention of getting weapons to be used in an insurrection against going into North Carolina and further south. That was his intention in doing that. So the abolitionists were very much pressing that, or some of them were, you had the same attitude in the South. So these things crystallize what happens. And the result is finally, of course, the Civil War occurs. The split is regional, as I mentioned. And churches separate. And it's not like they're fighting within an organization once the war starts. Well, the churches in the North did not have a relationship with those in the South and vice versa. I mean, you're crossing battle lines, literal military battle lines to do that. And so preachers, they were in the North, stayed in the North. Preachers in the South stayed in the South and the work that they did. And they were fully separated during that time. The churches would survive the Civil War. But the wounds that were caused, the divisiveness, will continue. And it will have an effect upon the direction that the church takes in the South, and the direction the church is taking in the North, as we will see. It's a horrible time, one that's difficult to study and to read about because of the things that went on. I put in here Ed Harrell's summation, one of the summations he gives about this horrible time in the sidebar on page 77. He wrote, "In sum, the disciples behaved a little different from most other religious groups during the Civil War. Christians North and Christians South prayed as they fought. They shared the hates and hopes and hardships and labors of their kinsmen and neighbors. And in the heat of human passion, disciples killed their brethren." I mean, it's awful to think about. But that's what was happening during that time. And that's why it is a low point in the history of our nation. Lincoln declares emancipation for the slaves, of course, during the war. And after the war, even though all are set free, it is a time actually before all slaves are set free. And then the time of Reconstruction begins. And the horrors of it, so many of those in the North wanting the South to be punished and to suffer for what they did, cause an even a greater stake to be drawn, dividing the two, that causes bitterness and acrimony between them for long after the war. So the Civil War has far-reaching effects upon the church. There is some reconciliation of sides after the war, just like it is in any great controversy. Before the controversy arises, it's a topic that discussed. And in the heat of the controversy, there's great debating and passion. And then after the controversy is over, things settle back down. And that's kind of what happens here. We'll see the same thing happen as we talk about pacifism. There is that change and in that outlook. Well, okay, let me stop a minute, see if anyone has some comments or thoughts on this, things they'd like to mention.
Hey, Steve, I have a question.
Yeah.
So I appreciate that you mentioned that slavery was not only a political issue, but it was also a moral issue.
All right.
So what do you think the church today should do when political issues happen to also be moral issues?
Yeah, well, I believe brethren as individuals have a responsibility to speak out against moral issues. I do not think the church becomes a political arm. I've never thought that the politics is what the pulpit is about. But I believe Christians as a part, as citizens of the nation, have a right and a responsibility to speak out against moral issues in our daily life. I really do. Take, for example, abortion. That is strongly a moral issue. I'm not opposed to that, for example, being discussed in the pulpit because it is such a strong moral issue. Prejudice is a moral issue that I would say discussed in the church. I think what I'm saying, and maybe I should have listened to your question. You're talking about political issues that are also moral issues, strong moral issues. I believe they,
yes.
When you look at what the scriptures say about something, I believe they can be addressed. I guess what I was thinking in the first, from the beginning, was just any political things, the idea of churches becoming political action committees and picking candidates and saying to the church, you ought to vote for this guy or that guy. I don't think the church has any place in doing that. But on moral issues of I believe, like abortion, racial prejudice, I think things like that that are clearly moral issues can be addressed.
Thank you.
Yeah, okay. That's my 2 cents worth, as people say. May not be worth that. Okay, any other comments or questions?
Actually, I do have another question.
Yeah.
And so you mentioned that the church suffered some division because of this as well.
Yeah.
Do you think it was appropriate for them to divide over it?
Here's the problem, and we're going to discuss this more in the next lesson. It's when you see a church begins to organize itself into some kind of national or regional organization that you begin to have the concept of churches dividing from churches. Every church is individual and autonomous, and each church makes its own decision. Now, a church takes a path, and there may be members that don't agree with it and leave and go to another one. But the concept of the church dividing even suggests the idea that they are one united organization to begin with. So there's a separation there that needs to be understood. Now, if I'm a part of a local church that I believe is morally practicing things that are wrong, I personally would have a responsibility. I believe that I could not fellowship those brethren and leave. That'd be my responsibility. Maybe this will be a little clearer. I'm not trying to avoid the question you're asking, but I think that finally that's going to come down to the individual and his relationship with his local church and dealing with that. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely think a lot of times we don't think about congregations as autonomous bodies, like you said, and sometimes that causes confusion about, well, did the church divide? Well, the church can't divide. So I think that's super well put. Thanks.
Yeah, and it's important we understand that. As I say, we get into the next lesson, we're going to discuss the American Christian Missionary Society. We're going to begin to discuss that very concept of what is the universal church and can it be united? Really what I'm talking about the division taking place in the church area, probably could be more accurately stated in saying division within the movement, because you're talking about, from a historical standpoint, a movement that's taking place in the society, and the movement does divide from that standpoint. And so maybe that's the way that it ought to be discussed. But we will discuss that topic more as we look at the divisive issue of the establishment of an American Christian Missionary Society to which all churches were supposed to contribute for mission work. We'll look at that. Okay, anything else?
Thank you.
Okay. Well, let's talk about pacifism some. Pacifism was not an issue that just came up when Civil War came along. It had been there from the very beginning. You will find pacifists during the War for Independence, 1776. You'll find pacifists going back throughout history in dealing with war, and of course, political as well as religious pacifists. But it does become an issue in the movement as the country goes to war. The War of 1812 raised the question of pacifism among a lot of brethren. There was actually a national organization called the American Peace Society that formed, that advocated pacifism and tried to get the government to support pacifism and to spread the idea. Again, early reformers were almost to a man pacifists. Martin W. Stone wrote against war. Alexander Campbell did extensively in their early years. Thomas Campbell was a pacifist. And you will find them writing on that subject. Yeah, Campbell sometimes even published articles from the journals that the American Peace Society had published in their journals. He would publish them in his paper, the Millennial Harbinger. So pacifism was very strong in the beginning of the movement. Again, it wasn't universal at all. And really, the thing that becomes the sticking point is not about Christians' participation in government. That also is issues that brethren have discussed, whether you have any part in government at all. But this was over the matter of serving in the military and going to war and carrying a weapon. That's really what this was more about in this context. I mentioned in the lesson that Alexander Campbell served as a delegate to Virginia's Constitutional Convention in the early 1800s when they were writing the Constitution. So they were not opposed to that. The mayor of Cincinnati was a member of the church, a close friend of Campbell's and other preachers in that area. So that wasn't the issue at that time as much as the matter of serving in the military. But of course, what again brings this to a head really is the approaching war, the Civil War, and the matter of taking up arms to defend your beliefs or to defend your state, your country. That begins to be a question. And so the two issues are inextricably intertwined during this time. You almost can't separate one from the other. Because going to war means defending a certain position on slavery. And so the two are intertwined. So as the war approaches, again, you run into the same situation in the churches that had existed as existing with slavery. That is, you're beginning to have a great division between pacifists and those who supported war, or going to war. And it gets acrimonious, the division over it. And again, you find leaders in the movement, like Campbell and others, writing, trying to find a moderate position that all can agree on so that the churches, the movement won't divide over this. And that's their greatest concern. And again, when you begin to think of the church on a national or universal scale instead of on a local scale, then this begins your thinking about uniting or dividing the whole church and issues dividing, and we've got to keep the church together instead of letting the local churches deal with these issues on their own. The influence of religious journals, of colleges, today of church media, those kinds of things, cause an individual or a particular organization to have influences far beyond just that of a local church or a local group. And that's part of what is happening during this time. The religious journals are read widely throughout the brotherhood, and even by those who are not Christians. Campbell's Millennial Harbinger read all over the country by brethren. And so what was discussed in there becomes what is discussed in churches throughout the area. Positions taken in the Harbinger become positions that are taken by brethren across the country. And though journals did a lot of good, they also played a role in division and the things that happened. brethren in the pacifist movement, and in, well, I mean, during the discussion on pacifism, see the writings. They want their positions heard in the papers and the journals. And as they're written upon, they do divide. Campbell would make efforts as long as he could to keep these kind of controversial topics out of being discussed in the papers because he knew what could happen. But eventually they would be forced into writing on them. And they did as much damage as they did good in trying to deal with these things. So finally, the pacifist position causes divisions again. The attitude of people who oppose it many times is overcome by them beginning to see, you know, I'm going to lose my home. I'm going to lose my livelihood, lose my family, if I don't take up arms and defend against the army that's coming to invade. And even though they were pacifists, they saw themselves as taking a defensive position. And whether they were in favor of slavery or against it, they felt they had to defend. And so there were pacifists who became non-pacifists during that time. And there were others who saw the horrors of war who became pacifists as a result of that. I've seen that happen. I can remember when I was a boy, I remember a man who, when we lived in Lufkin, Texas for a while when I was a little boy, a man there in the church, a couple of people told me, you know, said he was a World War II ace. You know, he was in Life magazine and all that. And you would have never known it. The man never talked about it. And they said he wouldn't talk about it and that he hated war and wanted nothing to do with it or ever talk about it again. Certainly the war had that effect upon a lot of people. So there are such mixed emotions and things that enter into this that confuse the two positions, but they do end up dividing brethren also during that time. Divisions overall are along regional lines, and those divisions do not completely heal after the war. As we're going to see, the things that the mindsets that develop in this and the divisions that take place are going to result, even though they will profess unity, it's going to result really in different mindsets in the different parts of the country. And churches begin to go in different directions with different emphasis upon what they think the church is all about and what it should be doing. And that's going to play a major role in what happens in the second half of the 19th century from 1850 to 1900. One of the things this really illustrates for me as I look at this is how the church has been and is always going to be affected by the great social issues of the day. As much as the church may want to separate itself from it, its members are citizens of the country, citizens of the nation, and they cannot separate from being that. And being a part of that earthly nation brings pressure up on them to take sides in political issues and in other issues like these we're discussing. And that obviously is going to bleed over into the church. And so social issues of the day become religious issues and can divide the church. We have to be very sure that we value being citizens of the kingdom of heaven far above being citizens of an earthly kingdom or an earthly nation. For our citizenship is heaven, is in heaven, Paul said in Philippians 3 and verse 20. That must be in our mind, and that must be at the forefront of any discussion that we have about the kind of issues that divide us or may divide us today. Today, we cannot let politics divide the Lord's church. We simply cannot let it happen. I do very little discussion of politics anymore, though I used to. I've become to focus upon what the Lord's church needs to hear to get to heaven and what it can do to influence others for righteousness' sake. Try to keep us out of those matters that are contrary to New Testament Christianity. There are other people and preachers that do not feel that way. But at my age, that's where I've ended up. And try to give myself to that. And when those issues arise, we've got to work to gently and patiently and lovingly try to discuss and solve those issues within the Lord's church so that we can continue to be one as the Lord prayed that we would all be one on the very night he prayed that before his crucifixion. Unity is emphasized over and over. Paul in Philippians 4 saying that we are to endeavor to keep the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace. I would have hated to be alive during that time we were talking about and going through that. It had to be horrible. It's tough enough in the times in which we lived, but it could not have been of any worse in the Lord's church than it was during that time. And let's pray we do not face those kind of situations again. Let's pray we don't. All right, any other comments or questions? Anything you want to bring up? All right, well, I hope this has been enlightening and helpful, and that there are lessons from this that we can apply that will help us as brethren as we try to work together as one. Okay, nothing else? All right, 7:47, did pretty good. Thanks for being here tonight and encourage others if they want to listen in. I think particularly this lesson is one a lot of people would like to hear something on. Mention to them to watch it on the website. It'll be on there. And I'll be glad to discuss this further with anybody. Okay. Thanks for being here tonight. Hope to see you Friday night.